Today on Minnesota Stories, we're talking to Nels Pearson. He grew up as a dairy farmer in Butterfield, Minnesota, and always had an interest in politics. He currently represents Rochester in the State House, and we're happy he could join us.
And to this day, whether it's a credit card statement or signing a bill at the Minnesota State House of Representatives, I sign my name with a cow every time.
All right, so we're recording. So I'm here today with State Rep Nels Pearson. Thanks for joining us. And I guess just to get right into it, could you give us a little background about where you grew up, where you're from, where you went to school, and that kind of thing?
Sure. Background, I grew up on a dairy farm in a town called Butterfield, Minnesota. And it's probably the one thing that identifies me the most with who I am and what I am. But growing up in a small town in southwestern Minnesota, my father was a dairy farmer, and we had purebred registered Guernsey cows.
How many head of cattle did you have?
We had about 50 milking cows most of the time, and then along with that, you've always got some heifers and some steers that we'd feed out for selling for beef use and as a cash market as well, and then of course a lot of crops with alfalfa to feed the cattle, corn, soybeans.
So this was fully automated dairy farm?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. We had a stanchion barn, which is pretty obsolete these days. Basically 13 stanchions on each side of the barn, not two sides, and then so we would shuttle the cattle in and out, is what you'd refer to that as, to rotate which cows were being milked, and milk twice a day, which these days in the large operations that are doing the large parlor operations that would dwarf the size of our stanchion barn, and then they'll be milking three times a day these days. So it's a much different operation than what you're seeing out in the current dairy industry.
I had some relatives, an uncle, and then a cousin that was my age, and they were on a dairy farm. People have no idea what that means,
right?
In terms of commitment, like when you think of commitment now, it's like, oh, I'll commit to a team or something like you. Vacations are non-existent.
The old dairy farmer joke with politicians is the fact that the politician was hearing this conference of dairy farmers and was kind of acting like he knew exactly what was going on, and the dairy farmer was talking about how they milk their cows twice a day, and the politician chimed in right away, oh, so 10 times a week. And, of course, the dairy farmers didn't really find that very authentic in his understanding of how cows are milked daily, of course. But it's a commitment, and for myself, I was the youngest of four kids, so I'll acknowledge and thank my older siblings. They definitely took the brunt of the chores, they were certainly hard workers also, and always have a lot of respect for my siblings. And what we went through was really challenging, and it truly has defined who I am. My father actually had a cardiomyopathy diagnosed the days after I was born. In fact, as I was being delivered, the doctor didn't like the way my dad looked and asked him to come into the hospital the next week. And that follow-up appointment was when he was diagnosed with a heart virus, essentially, that would continue to deteriorate his heart during the course of my youth and eventually would create the need for him to get a heart transplant, which he actually had performed when I was a junior in high school. So my father's struggles with his health, and fortunately the family, you know, sticking together and working hard and getting things done with equipment that was new in the 70s, but with the farm crisis of the 80s, a lot of the upkeep and maintenance that was needed wasn't necessarily done, and a lot of that fancy automated equipment that we had, simple things like conveyor belts, had to be transferred to 5-gallon buckets carrying pails and pails of silage and haylage and corn and feed all throughout different barns and in different parts of the operation. So it was a challenging youth. I look at what my children are growing up with and all of the temptations and things that are around them. And as I grew up, I often tell people I didn't really have the opportunity to fool around or get in trouble because I was there home working on the farm with my siblings. And we were certainly blessed to have the farm. And we were able to survive the farm crisis, which, you know, looking back, I had a lot of neighbors that weren't necessarily that fortunate, and it wasn't easy, but we stuck together, and it was certainly, again, something that defined my youth and my life.
And, you know, when you walk in and you say that it defines your life, it's when I see you, it's not the first thing I think of, that this is a farm boy. You got a nice sport jacket on, you're very presentable. Not that farmers are not, but, you know, thinking about throwing around silage and dealing with cows and stuff like that. So I don't take it that you were milking any cows this morning.
No,
You've taken a different path than some of your other family. So what's your educational background and the field of study and then vocation that you got into?
Yeah, certainly a fair question. The fact that I was not the oldest was something that made me recognize that I would probably have to find a different path because there was only one farm and my brother really had made it clear that he wanted to continue in the agricultural field. And so I've always known that I'd have to find a different path. And I was fortunate to have great opportunities through FFA and 4-H that gave me some skill sets that progressed me to my interests in college. And I ended up going to Gustavus Adolphus College. It was close enough to Butterfield where during my first year, I actually was able to drive back home on weekends and still help my dad out on the dairy operation a little bit. And then, you know, not much after I left the farm, though, my dad decided to sell off the dairy. Most of the dairy cattle were gone then. I started in political science and speech communications it was kind of interesting because speech communications classes were, for me, classes I could get very easy A's in. It was a skill set I already had developed and certainly public speaking aspects of it.
It wasn't your greatest fear in life.
But even, I can't relate to that issue for apparently many Americans.
Just for a second, you had mentioned that the FFA gave you certain skill sets. I think, again, I grew up in a rural town, but I'd work on farms for short periods of time, but not kind of in that culture all the time. My idea with FFA is talking about how to raise cows and, you know, get them ready for the fair. That's my limited knowledge of it. What kind of things were you learning there that helped you later on?
Well, I think that's a fair acknowledgement from people from the outside looking in, because what's usually publicly viewed is maybe you go to a cattle show or a county fair or some type of state fair even, and that's what you're going to see is that what's visible is who are the kids that are showing these cattle. Oh, they're FFA members, and that must be what they do. But most of those organizations, agriculture classes throughout the state of Minnesota, as I've actually been in the agriculture committees for the legislature, throughout the state of Minnesota, agriculture education classes have actually filled the role of a lot of our science, technology, engineering, and math core curriculum sets for a lot of these smaller schools. And they'll basically take, you know, agronomy and they'll study the biology of seeds and planting and growing. And it actually is fulfilling a lot of those requirements that, maybe wouldn't have been as engaging to youth as they're going through their junior high and senior high years. And so agriculture classes feed into a pipeline of members who decide to join the club that's referred to as FFA, and basically from ninth grade through most of your college years, you're actually allowed to be in an FFA chapter. And those club organizations, that's actually where a lot of that leadership role is developed and designed. They'll have monthly meetings, or they'll have, you know, timely meetings that will help them organize for fundraising and help them organize. And there's a lot of skill sets, like just basic parliamentary procedure, that's taught at those club levels. And, you know, having, again, followed in the footsteps of my older siblings in most of those situations, I was always watching what was done at a 4-H club and became the club president and eventually a county president for you know, our 4-H clubs. And then same thing in FFA, you know, you just start running meetings, and there's a lot of organization to that. And, you know, they have get-togethers, and just like any other club or organization you can think of, they have other things to do outside of just showing the cows or planting the seeds.
Yeah, and thank you for expounding on that. So that was really the start of your political career then. And I don't know how political it got back then, but you said you went into political science. What piqued your interest in politics?
Yeah, I think, you know, even before that, I would acknowledge that my parents, while they weren't necessarily specifically involved in political party organizations, they were always talking about and making observations about politics, politicians, what was going on, and how it affected their daily life. And, you know, my mother and father are from families with six siblings total on each side. So same. Lots of aunts and uncles, and so it's a great mix. And a lot of times those discussions, I don't know why, I would always just sit down and listen to those, even in my elementary years. And I do remember my mom running for the school board in our local school district in Butterfield, Odin. And that was, you know, influential for me. It was that ability to step forward and take that role, and recognizing there's very little glory in being a school board member. There's typically controversy. People don't agree on all these issues every time. But I think what I always drew from that was just the whole idea that, and there was no partisanship in a local school board, race like that. But it was just this idea that there aren't Democrats and Republicans in those situations. We're all in this together. We're all in this for what's best for the kids and what's best for the schools and how we make this survive. And so that just always interested me. Yeah, something about the political science courses at college just always kind of seemed, it always seemed like there was so much power and so much control there. And, you know, you just get kind of drawn to it a little bit. But for me personally, that's why I was studying politics. But for me personally, you know, I ended up on campus. I was the student council president as well. So, you know, it was just still always trying to help an organization and lead people, you know, to have the best opportunities that we can make available to them.
Sure. So did you have any particular career in mind while you were going to college?
I still don't have any particular career in mind. So I find that the question a little bit peculiar to even think about today, because I often tell people I don't know what I want to do when I grow up. So, you know, it was, you know, it's a liberal arts school, and I actually do truly believe in the liberal arts education platform and format. And I've kept in touch with enough of my college classmates to know they are doing things that have absolutely nothing to do with what they studied in college. But I don't know that with a liberal arts education that's necessarily the goal that people are seeking either. So I always knew I wanted to be working with people, and that actually is kind of what led me after college. That's what led me to Rochester. It was, you know, seeking a job in those areas coming out of college was a unique experience, because one thing I did know is I did not want to live in a large city. So growing up in Butterfield, a population around 500, and of course it's in schools, it's merged with Odin, which is 160 people. So that's that's always very fun to explain to people that these merged schools are still, once you add up the whole population, they're still much smaller than most towns in southeastern Minnesota here.
Most but individual school populations.
Right, right. So then I went to St. Peter, Minnesota, is where Gustavus is, and there's about 9,000 people that were living in St. Peter at the time that I was there. And I did an internship while I was at Gustavus in Minneapolis, and that large city environment was just still not my thing, and I kind of knew that. So when I was looking for jobs in the political science speech communications fields, I'd be looking in southwestern Minnesota where I grew up, and, you know, maybe you could work for a radio station. Maybe you could...
Maybe expound on what jobs that would even entail.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could sell advertising, or you could be on air, but, I mean, these aren't lucrative career paths necessarily in small market areas of southwestern Minnesota. So, you know, I really did struggle coming out of college just to try to find a career path within my degrees of education. What I came to realize is that having a political science speech communication degree qualifies you for selling cars. So I moved to Rochester in October of 1995 after having interviewed for a position to sell cars at one of our local dealerships here in Rochester. And I kind of enjoyed that. That was my career move. And It was interesting because it totally wouldn't necessarily be a fit. And of course, anyone could walk into a car dealership probably and get the job back in 1995. But I remember committing to the guy who hired me. I said, I'll be here for at least a year. And I had a pretty decent first couple of months. And the third month was, the third month would have been December and January. You know, these were the cold months of the year, and if you went to the almanac of January of 1996, that was a year where we had 4 inches of snow every night and whipping winds and freezing, blowing temperatures all through the days.
That drove all people to
yes.
car dealerships.
Yeah, no, the lot was empty, but we still had to move the cars every morning so that we could plow the rows just in case anyone showed up and wanted to look at a car. So there was a lot of physical maintenance involved in actually getting out, and that's what a car salespeople will typically do on those snowy days. The good news is they buy you pizza when there's a snow day at most car dealerships, so we had a pretty good time with that. But I remember in December and January, the sales manager basically saying this wasn't working out because I wasn't selling enough cars. And while January was horrific in weather, February wasn't much better. And in Minnesota, at that dealership at that time, I sold 7 brand new cars in February. And that actually was the top salesperson for new cars at that dealership in February of 1996. So I got a little plaque with my name on it, because that's what they did every month, was top new and top used car salespeople.
Do you have that in your office up in St. Paul?
I do not. I'd have to pull that out of a box of them that I ended up with, because in 1996, I ended up being the top new car salesman that year. And in 97, 98, 99, and 2000, I was always the top new car salesperson at that dealership. So I had a very successful run in the car business, and I attribute a lot of that to, again, having the public speaking background, having that confidence, having that education, and a lot of positive things that happened, and people enjoyed buying cars from me. I think they I made it a pleasant experience. There's one little tick that still shows up every day as I'm living my life that I learned from the car business, and that was, you know, when you sell cars, you need to make sure that if they don't buy a car that day, they come back and ask for you, right?
Sure.
So this whole idea that I was a dairy farmer from Butterfield was certainly more marketable than virtually anything else I could think about. So in my office, I had cows hanging up on the wall. I had milk and cookies for my clients if they came in for a test drive or they were just coming in for an oil change. I absolutely, milked that specific concept all the way to the fact that if someone came in to drive a car, test drove a car, when I sent them a thank you note, I would sign my name and I drew a little cow on my signature. And to this day, whether it's a credit card statement or signing a bill at the Minnesota State House of Representatives, I sign my name with a cow every time. And people will remember, they won't remember my name because it's not, sometimes people would come in and ask, is Lars here or Hans or something?
Sure, random anything Scandinavian
but,
names.
No, yeah, as long as it's Scandinavian, they thought maybe they had it right. But I would actually turn around and tell people, just ask for the dairy farmer from Butterfield. And people would remember that. And to this day, I'll be in Target. And people will walk up to me and say, oh, hey, the dairy farmer. And of course, I haven't milked a cow in a while, so my brother gives me a really hard time about that. But
see, I thought this podcast was going to be about politics. That marketing nugget there of finding your niche of for getting people to remember you is gold.
Absolutely.
I mean, that is an incredible value that you've just given anybody who's listening to this. Back home, I have it that even still, and I haven't played hockey now for half my life, it's, oh, are you the hockey guy? And they'll say that to me. And I'm one of three brothers. They all played hockey. Are you the hockey one? Well, we all play, but yes. Eventually, you just
own
lean
it.
Just lean into it. Hi, I'm
the hockey guy.
Yeah, I worked as a lawyer for a while. Yeah, hi, I'm Tyler. I'm the hockey guy lawyer, and I ended up getting more clients through playing hockey with a bunch of real estate agents,
sure,
than any other avenue that I took, and it was literally just playing hockey for lunch. So you eventually got into real estate, which you're doing currently.
Sure.
But I'd like to kind of shift this to the politics. So you had a good run at the car dealership. I expect that at the same time you were still involved to some extent in the community. What kind of things were you doing during that time?
Yeah, I think it does all kind of blend together at a certain point, and I would say it's all still blending together. That relationship of being a successful car salesperson. Part of that was my involvement in the community. I used to announce for the Rochester Water Ski Show team. And, it's just something I didn't know how to water ski. I didn't know very many people in town because I'd moved from Butterfield, right? So I was trying to get to know people, and somebody, a roommate of mine, advised me that I should join this team. So I did, and you know, I'd sell cars to people who were in the team, and I was still interested in politics, so I kind of knew what was going on, and I thought, as a salesperson, that makes sense to get involved in a local political party organization as well, and the Republican Party is certainly in line with my political concepts and constructs of the time. So I was working to help other candidates back then in the 90s. I was very excited about our lieutenant governor at the time was Joanne Benson, and she was going to run for governor of the state of Minnesota. She was Arnie Carlson's lieutenant governor. And when she threw her hat in the ring, I was very excited. I did a lot of campaigning for her locally here and went to the caucus system for the first time, which is an important aspect of Minnesota politics, is getting involved at that caucus level. Really is really the only way to officially become a member of your political party in the state of Minnesota, is to be there on that Tuesday night in February for caucuses. And I was there and got involved, and I got elected as my precinct chair or whatever it was at the time, because frankly, I was probably the only person under 50 in the caucus room at the time, and they were so excited to see someone young that was coming through the pipeline and wanted to get involved, and was they were all very much embracing the idea of this fresh out of college individual that political was science, that was willing to step forward guy. And so I got involved, and I started showing up at the county meetings. Every month they have a county organizational meeting, and that's they call it the Central Committee. Both political parties actually schedule them the same night in our Olmsted County area here. And for me, it was just natural to show up at the meetings because, like I mentioned earlier, I've been doing meetings through 4-H and FFA, and this was parliamentary procedure. I knew my way around the activities that they were participating in. And there was an opening in the local county party. 1 month they had announced someone had moved out of the area, and there was this opening in the rural events chair was the name of the position on the executive committee that had opened up. Now this is the executive committee, mind you, and this is a big deal, right? So I walk in, and they said you just have to show up at the next executive meeting if you're interested. So I show up. Well, I didn't realize that they also hadn't filled the co-chair's position at the time either. And so I was walking in volunteering to be on this rural events chair, and they said, well, Nels, you've been coming to all these meetings. We think it'd be great if you ran for the co-chair position. And again, I'm, I don't know, probably 24, 25 at the time, and there's all these people who have lived in Olmsted County all their lives. They certainly know more people. They certainly are more active.
And there's people at the table that have probably been there absolutely for more than 24 years.
Absolutely, so intimidating. But again, they were so excited to have someone younger who was interested, and they embraced that. And I said, sure. So I became the Olmsted County co-chair back in the late 90s. And that really, that activity got me more involved, and I ended up being a campaign chair for a state representative candidate at the time in 2002. Would have been Carla Nelson, who won her election in 2002, and she is actually now a state senator. And then I ended up working for a congressman in his campaign in 2004. I got to go to work for Congressman Gil Gutnick. I was his campaign manager, which the first congressional district is pretty much everywhere I've lived throughout my life. Butterfield is in the western part of the district. Gustavus Adolphus College is actually right in the middle of the district in St. Peter. And now I'm, of course, in Rochester, certainly know this territory and area very well. But working in that role and helping on a campaign for the first congressional district was really, I mean, it was a dream job, you know. So at that time, that's a professional career. That was the first time I worked professionally in a paid position in politics in 2004, but it took a while to kind of learn the ropes of politics and having carried a lot of water for political candidates in the past really helped me get in that specific role.
And so you had said 94 to 2004? It wasn't that long.
So I moved to this area in October 95. Probably 96, I think, would have been. I'd have to look it up and see if that's even a governor's race for when Joanne Benson was running. But that's sure. When I started getting involved locally.
But I think the thing that stuck out for me in your story there, because that sounds like because we're talking about it in just a few minutes, it sounds like this rocket, you know, from showing up at a meeting to helping somebody get elected to Congress. It's, but what really stuck out is where you said at 24 you were being asked to be co-chair. That, how simple it is, and just the fact that somebody's interested and that there's new blood in there, because I experienced this myself too in doing something similar, just looking to get involved, how simple that process is. If there's somebody out there, not necessarily 24, maybe, you know, maybe 18, maybe 24, maybe 34, maybe 50, whatever the age that's looking to get involved, how hard is it to get involved in the party? And what are the typical first steps? And you're obviously seeing it from the Republican Party, but I expect it would be the same for the Democrats as well. What are the first steps, and how hard is it to get involved to some extent?
Yeah, the level of involvement is really, it's kind of a, the question relates to how do you want to get involved? If you want to get involved with candidates, pick up the phone and volunteer to help them, and they will take you. I guarantee you they will find you something to do. If you're looking to impact the political party and actually become somebody who chooses who the candidates are going to be, the state of Minnesota has this caucus system, and it is very rigid. You're there on that Tuesday night. If you can't make it on that Tuesday night and you want to be a delegate or an alternate moving forward to these other conventions, you just submit a letter, and you have someone read the letter signed by you saying you're willing to do that. And in most of these wards and precincts in Rochester or the townships that are here in Olmsted County or the small towns, there are certain years where those delegations won't even fill coming out of a specific ward or precinct because there maybe just isn't a lot of energy or enthusiasm. The presidential election of 2016 was not that year. If you were a Democrat or a Republican, you actually may have had done a lot of work historically within the county organizations for candidates or just the political party. And depending on how well a specific faction or candidate's organization was being run, you may be completely blocked out of the process because a majority of people were supporting a candidate that you weren't in line with. So depending on the year, there are certain times when you can waltz right in and say, hey, I'd love to help out. And that's what happened to me when it happened to be the governor's race of Joanne Benson, who we ended up endorsing Norm Coleman that year. And that's the year that Jesse Ventura won the governorship here in the state of Minnesota. I always say if Joanne Benson had gotten that endorsement, there is no way Governor Ventura could have defeated Joanne Benson the same way he went after Norm Coleman and Roger Moe at that time. But that's a whole another podcast.
Sure. And so, yeah, we're obviously not going to get into the whole caucus program and how that system works and the things that you said, but I would expect there's a lot of information about how it works, and literally anybody can walk in and participate to some extent, literally, even if it's just to see how the whole system works.
Yep.
You can walk in, and I expect, and from my experience, there's lots of people there that are really happy to share how the whole system works and how you might be able to get involved to some extent.
Yes. There's, again, in 2016, we had standing room only in a lot of the caucus rooms. We were not anticipating the overwhelming number of people that were supporting multiple candidates. And you know, everyone could, obviously people will make the assumption I'm talking about Donald Trump. But Donald Trump actually didn't win in the state of Minnesota during our straw polls of the Republican Party at that time. So there were a multitude of candidates that were all bringing a lot of support. And so that process was accessible, but I also noticed it was rather frustrating to many people because some people walked into that room thinking they could just cast a ballot, like we were just voting that night. And that isn't necessarily what a caucus is.
Sure.
The caucus is really our base, our absolute core organization level of who in the state of Minnesota are our Republican people and what do they believe in. We actually discuss and debate the party's platform within that caucus system. And if people want to make changes to the party platform, they submit their proposal for making a platform change. So, you know, any either both political parties have these platforms, and it's what's guiding the candidates as they move forward, and it's often what people will cite as to whether or not they support a specific candidate for the Republicans' endorsement. What also is frustrating for people is the inability for that to move swiftly. It's a slow process. It takes a lot of time. There's a lot of debate. And there are a lot of people that are not willing to sit through that. And so that's one of the, it's almost like it feeds into itself. Like if you aren't willing to go through that long, arduous process, it weeds out a lot of people from being interested in either of the political parties. And so that's where some people just decide, I'm not going to do that part of it. So what we end up with are people who are hyper-dedicated to specific issues that end up influencing that process, that they're so committed to those issues that they're willing to sit through that long debate. In fact, they're the ones standing up and making the debate longer if they can, because they don't want people who are just timidly interested in the political party. Now, for me, I think the party process is great. I just wish more people would have the patience for it. I wish more people would commit to it and get involved and be more passionate about their specific issues. We just kind of sometimes end up with a very small audience of people that end up controlling that. And so I always tell people the parties belong to the people who show up. Like I told you, I showed up, went to the meetings regularly. Next thing you know, they made me the co-chair of the local party. Nobody ever in that process, never once, did they ask me where I stood on any issue.
Sure.
Never once. No one ever said, well, we can't elect this guy because he's too hard on this or too soft on that.
Right.
It was never about a political idea. Do you show up? Do you care? You know, do you work? Are you willing to carry some water for the candidates and get the job done? And so for me, I think it's important to have people understand that, yeah, you do have to be committed and you do have to care and show up.
It's like I was talking to you before, it's this strange situation where it's a lot easier to get involved than you think, but then it's also a lot harder to stay involved than you think. And it might just be that patience. But eventually you got to the point where you're talking about passion and commitment, where you decided to take the very strange decision in today's day and age to actually run for office. What went into that? Can you just tell me how you went from being campaign chair, county chair, co-chair of the party, that you said, you know, now I'm going to take on this job where I get to, you know, every weekend for the rest of my life, I'm going to be at a cheese festival or something
like
that.
Well, I get to go to exotic places like Sterling Studios, though, and, sure. and do this interview. This is just remarkable. I can't believe how the vault is lined with gold. It's just amazing here.
There's always there's highlights to everything.
I wish there were video of this so people could actually see the environment that we're sitting in right now. But
state of the art.
I would say we skip over one very critical aspect of something that probably defines my path too, and that's actually the loss in 2006. So in 2004, I was hired. Congressman Gutnick got reelected in 2004, and then Congressman Gutnick was defeated by now Governor Tim Walz, but a school teacher from Mankato, a rather politically unknown individual, stepped forward and ran against our congressman at the time, who I was the campaign manager for. So I often remind people that it's all my fault. And it was a complicated, difficult year in 2006, and a lot of things fed into the rise of candidate Walz. But I did actually take that defeat very personally, and I did take that pretty hard in 2006. I ended up getting completely out of the political process and system. I ended up, again, I always tell people I run with the wrong crowds, but I ended up being the new car sales manager at another local auto dealership here in town. And had a pretty good run until the automobile crisis of 2009, probably 3 months before the automobile industry bailout and cash for clunkers and all those great stories. Just a few months before that, I was actually let go from the position that I was in at that time. So a lot of bad things led into this story, right?
Sure.
So then I reassessed, and that's actually what began my path exploring real estate. And I, at the moment that I was let go from the auto dealership here in town,
that also wasn't the best time to get into real estate.
No, it wasn't. Most people, of course not. Right. At the exact same time, the law school, Hamline University, had sent out an email to me. And it was basically like they were doing like a satellite discussion on what it's like to do their law school programs at Hamline University. And so in 2008, so it'd been October 2008, that happens. And it was just like, it was meant to be, because I get the news on a Saturday that I'm let go, and this meeting is supposed to be on Tuesday night here locally. And I should have been working on Tuesday night, so I wasn't going to go to this meeting about law school. So I go to the meeting, and I decide this is something I should continue down the path of. And they have a weekend law school program at Hamline. Had great, sounded like a great, interesting path to take. And I just started taking the steps. Like, you take the LSAT. Did okay. Submit the application. Get accepted.
We'll compare our LSAT.
You take your
afterwards.
First. Yeah, right. Yeah. You take the first semester of classes, and I did all right. You know, mm-hmm. So I just kept going through that, and at the same time, you know, again, because I'm married with children, you know, at that time there's responsibilities too. So I got involved in real estate, and it was the housing bubble, and so. There's always opportunities in real estate because, you know, there's foreclosures.
Sure.
And so foreclosures are a good value for someone out there. And if people could get approved by the banks at that time, there were good opportunities there. And I was working with a lot of clients and, help make those things happen. And in the meantime, on weekends, I'd head up to law school. So that whole chapter is separate and got through law school, got through
but it wasn't real estate. It wasn't all rosy. It wasn't a through the door and everything just an upward trajectory. You actually encountered some pretty difficult times.
In July of 2000 or June of 2013, I took a trip to Spain with my family, including my mom. We went on this this excursion to Spain. And I'm in Spain on vacation, just enjoying life. And I get a phone call from the president of the Chamber of Commerce here in Rochester. And he says, I understand that Mike Benson is going to announce that he's running for Congress on Monday. Mike Benson was my state representative at the time. And so he calls me and says, we think you should announce on Tuesday that you're running for Mike Benson's state house seat. So that's actually how all of that got started is I
got a
phone call.
Were there talks before this? You obviously knew the chamber president.
Of course. I've known John Wade for quite some time. And so it really kind of boiled down again to, like, someone realized there's going to be this opening. And you get a phone call, and there I am on vacation with my wife and kids. And, of course, we talk about it. It wasn't like I could announce on Tuesday, though, that I was just going to make this leap. And so we talked about it, and a month later we announced that we were running for the state House seat. So, you know, that's a huge head start for most candidates. Like the fact that you know ahead of time that someone's going to do that just kind of allows you that opportunity. And then, we got going early. And so I've been running for the seat since July of 2013 and then got elected in November of 2014, of course. So,
and I've seen you at basically every event since. So how, so the decision to where you say you started campaigning for, just so that people know, it's not, where they happen to see you, that's not the only event that you go to. I know you attend a lot of different things.
Sure. And again, I think that culture or that concept goes back to just being an active member of the community, which goes back to 1995 selling cars. I mean, again, I didn't just walk into the role of state legislature and start showing up at things. I was at things before that also. And so I think in a lot of ways it maybe even goes one step further back, because we talk about Butterfield in a small town. And there's something about being in a small town where if you aren't in choir or band, or you don't sign up for the play, or you don't join a sports team or two, your small town might not have a choir or band or the sports team, or the play
sure
won't go on, because we needed virtually everyone to participate. And so I think for me, I just always didn't just think of working as the only thing I was going to do. I'm always going to be out there doing these other things too. It's like extracurricular for adulthood. I mean, I'm interested in what's going on in my community. I try to help out other people. Today I'm a realtor, that's my path and my full-time job. But typically as a realtor, I see my role as just trying to put connections together and solve problems for people. Someone owns this building and they need a tenant. Well, it's a good fit for this other person, or I have this house or I'm looking for this house. And it's bringing buyers and sellers together. It's solving those problems. I only find those connections and contacts if I'm out in the community talking to people. People constantly come up to me at chamber events or wherever, and that's who I am, so that's where the conversation goes. Now, most people will come up and talk to me about politics. I still want to talk about real estate because, that's my full-time job, but the political thing is important to my constituents and the people around me also, but I don't want people to forget I'm a realtor.
For sure.
As well.
Yeah.
So.
And with everything, I know that you've done some real estate development with your wife. Is she an architect?
Yes. Yeah. Well, she's not a licensed architect, but she worked for an architecture firm for 15 years here in Rochester. They ended up merging last summer with a larger firm, and she decided that because we're adopting, again, from the Democratic Republic of Congo, we will be hopefully bringing home he's now 1 year old, son from Congo, and so she didn't want to go to that more structured environment, and she's branched out on her own and does home design work for individuals and businesses and is making a very, very good run of her new business as well.
Good. And she's, I know that your family is involved in your campaigns because I've seen pictures of you of the whole gang at parades and the like. So they're obviously involved in it as well, because I could just imagine, and not to get into, I try to keep this pretty positive, and I think that a lot of it is you seem like a very positive person, but there's certain scrutiny with running for office, maybe at the state representative level. It doesn't happen to the same extent where they're getting, trying to find dirt on you or anything like that. But how does your family, do they enjoy being involved in campaigning? Or maybe it's just you trying to pass on that same idea of being civically involved?
I think, you know, we've always just tried to make it fun for the kids, and it's, they know that that's what I'm going to be doing for these. And it's a small district, so we have five parades that we have to do every season.
And what kid doesn't like a parade?
Right, yeah. Except they want to be sitting there getting candy like all the other kids. But we actually encourage them to invite their friends, and that is actually one of the reasons why it's been, frankly, just more energetic and all around more enjoyable to do. And so they'll invite their friends, my one son plays hockey, so he has a bunch of friends who do the inline skating during the parades, and that's just always visually interesting.
Sure.
You can't do that at the Viola parade, though, because there's some gravel sections, so that doesn't work real well. But, you know, we just try to have fun with it, and, you know, most of the time it's something I look forward to. I like talking to the people. I love shaking hands. I love getting out and interacting with kids and introducing myself. But, you know, it's actually kind of the idea that when you do that, there are just other things you won't be doing. I won't be taking my boat out on Lake Zumbro and
sure.
teaching the kids to water ski or something like that during those exact same moments. So it's the substitution and how you still make it fun. And it's nothing makes me happier than seeing one of my kids' schoolmates wearing one of my parade T-shirts out in public. And I'm like, oh, great. They actually like the shirt, it turns out.
Sure, so perfect.
That's always fun to see. Those really make me smile.
So there's a couple questions not related, not super politically motivated. The first one is, I can't imagine, I've done a few things in life where the relief after accomplishing it was so great that whatever difficulties there were before, they make for a funny story that I can, you know, make comical later. But the relief was so much, was so very much worth it. Where you said that you had so much disappointment and put it on yourself for when Gil Gutnick lost that election. When you win an election, I can only imagine after the campaigning and talking with people and people believing in you and volunteering their time, what does that feel like to when you finally hear Nels Pearson has won his district?
So it's been different every year. The very first year, of course, it was just you just have no idea what's going on, and you know, you might feel good about things, and everyone tells you to their face that you got this in the bag, and this is the slam dunk, and you know, you're doing such a great job. I, you know, can't imagine that you'd lose. You know, that very first victory party, it really is just overwhelming. I mean, everything you've been working for, and that year in particular, we started in July of 2013. We had been running for office for over a year, right? And it was such a focus, and to have that relief and accomplishment was overwhelming. But actually, it's the moment that you're sworn in, and you recognize that you now stand with such a small group of individuals who have served in the Minnesota State House of Representatives. You look at that on a historical lens suddenly, and it takes on a much deeper, broader, bigger meaning. And so just the honor that becomes then at that point, and the recognition that this is something that's very meaningful and very significant, and nothing else. Of course, my beautiful children, my loving wife, they're all amazing, but this is just something that I've achieved. It's just got my name on it, right?
Sure.
And the seat is, it's the fact that the public entrusts you for that seat, but knowing how many people who have been in that seat before you and what that does to how important that is for the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, I can totally see that overwhelming, I can understand. We've talked in the past, you know, again, with trying not to get too political, but try to do it in a way that's positive, because that's the way that you presented to me in the past, where you say you get sworn in. Obviously, the political rhetoric is, or rhetoric, is that people are just bashing heads all the time. And you have been able to share stories, and some other people have shared stories about how, yes, people don't necessarily agree, but that you've been helped significantly by people who are on the other side of the aisle. Can you share a story about that?
Yeah, the media likes to talk about when there's conflict, of course, right? And so sometimes there's just certain things that will happen behind the scenes. My first term in office, Representative Phyllis Kahn, who, you know, she was actually sworn into office as I was, just days after I was born. So she'd been in office for 40 plus years by the time I'd gotten into the legislature. And I was in the majority and she was in the minority during my first term. And it was just an interesting dynamic, because on the House floor, she just sat a couple seats away from myself. And we would talk all the time. And what I really learned from her was really just some basic rules of decorum on the House floor, of how we treat each other, how even when we're in debate, we don't call into questions the motives of the other members. We really need to go after the substance of what we're talking about, what the issue is and how it's going to impact the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And that's an important component. Her helping me learn some of those things made me want to sign on to a bill that she authored at that time. And it's a little bit of a ceremonial bill, because in the state of Minnesota, conflict minerals are not allowed to be sourced via federal law. And so there was a bill she was submitting, and it really goes towards saying Minnesota will make sure that we're following federal law in sourcing conflict minerals. And conflict minerals, for me personally, we're talking about minerals that are mined out of the mountains in Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo is where I've now two sons adopted from the DRC. And so those minerals are being mined, and then the funds are being used to basically fund these conflicts. And we talk about conflict diamonds a lot of times, but conflict minerals are really kind of the same type of thing. That bill wasn't extremely important to either caucus. It wasn't a high priority. And I knew Phyllis was the author of it in the House, and I knew the chair of the committee that bill was sitting in. And we're in the last week of session, and I knew the bill wasn't scheduled to get a hearing. And I just asked the chair of that committee, could you do a hearing on this bill for Representative Kahn? And I've never even told Representative Kahn that I did that. And she did get the hearing. And I really can't think of anything that was more meaningful than sitting in the audience watching the testimony and Phyllis being able to deliver that message. The bill doesn't pass, right? But the message was delivered to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, how important this was to her. It's important to me also. And coming full circle now, a Senate author has picked up the bill again this session and asked me to be the author of that bill. And Senator Pappas doesn't even know that story of how I got the hearing either, because I didn't tell anyone else. This is the first time I'm sharing this at all. But it's one I'm looking forward to signing and putting in the hopper.
Sure.
And we'll see if I get a hearing.
Those are the nice stories that, you know, that you hear from a lot of people who serve about, you know, sometimes they even find their mentor for how to act in the legislature on the other side of the aisle. And like you said, it's not always the story that gets picked up by media, but it's not as cutthroat. Obviously, people care very passionately about different issues, But at the end of the day, there's kind of a respect that they're trying to do what's best for the people that they represent. So with this podcast, I try to ask three questions, and just for like a couple sentence, and we'll, a lot of times we'll just tack this on the start as kind of a little premonition of what's going to happen later. So what do you say is has been your greatest success? Or what's been your greatest success? You've talked about, you know, being a farmer, being a father, being a, what do you see has been your greatest success? Actually, let me change that, and we'll cut all that out, because that's tough, because you got a family and kids and all that stuff too.
Right.
So what else? I'll change it around. Like I said, we can cut all this out. So the question that I'll ask is, you've found success in the FFA. You've found success in college. You've found success going to law school with your family, with your so in business and now in politics. What do you think contributed most to your success in all those areas? Was there anything that you can point to?
So I think in all of those areas, it's just stepping forward and being heard. It's just getting involved and getting the job done. You know, a lot of people will step forward and they've got a lot to say. But then you do need to back that up. You need to actually do the work. You need to actually show up on time, get the job done. And for me, there wasn't an option, again, growing up on the farm, there wasn't an option if the calves in the old chicken barn, if the calves in the old chicken barn didn't have 5-gallon pails of water carried out to them, That isn't an option. These aren't optional things. These are things that have to get done every day. And so I'm wired like a dairy farmer to this day to just get up, get out, and do the job.
That's a really good answer. What, you know, in having these different paths that you've gone, you know, historically, like your father was a farmer, it was kind of, at one point he committed to it and he was set. My father worked in a factory. He committed to it when he was 19. It was the best job to provide for his family, and it was just set. You've tried a number of different things, and even today, you know, it's that you are a realtor and you're committed to that, but you look for different opportunities as well. But have there been any hindrances that you've had, or hurdles that you've had to overcome to achieve your success? Again, I can cut all this down, and give you some time to think about it. But basically what I'm looking for is, there's a lot of people out there that think, oh, I'd love to run for office, but this, and it's just to give them a realistic view of what the hurdle is, or whether it's to get into real estate, or whether it's to adopt a kid from Congo, or whatever it is. And it's kind of tough when I say it in all these different areas. So if it was just in politics, what was the hardest hurdle? Maybe we'll do it that way.
Well, I think people will look at me and assume that I can walk into a room and I'll automatically know so many people in the room. I'm not very good with names. I oftentimes can't immediately remember who someone is or when the last time we'd have a conversation was. And as extroverted as I might seem, I'm more introverted than that. So I think some people assume that everyone is super good at that stuff. And if you're not, that you should stay out of the arena. And I think, again, going back to the car sales days, you either walked up to a complete stranger and asked to help them, or you didn't get paid, which meant you didn't eat. So, I mean, these are things where you just have to force yourself to get out there. You have to force yourself to meet a stranger, and every day meet a new stranger, and try not to show up at a specific event that maybe you go to every month and talk to the same three people. Go out and talk to new people. Find out new perspectives and get to understanding what exactly is fueling what's going on in our local area deeper than your own echo chamber. And I think these days, especially with social media, we a lot of times get trapped in our own little echo chambers, and we forget to look at the perspective of people that we don't always agree with.
And my third question, if you had a magic wand right now and could change one thing. So like I said, I've not been getting into the political stuff. If you want to throw yourself under the bus, you can do that. But if you had a magic wand right now and could change anything in your life, in the world, what would it be?
Right now, it would be bringing my son home from Congo. We still think it'd be another 3 to 6 months before he's home. And that's if things are politically stable there, which there are indications that that may not be the case. So getting him home is extremely important to
for sure.
My wife and my family.
And no doubt. Last question. Who would you like to hear from on this podcast? And maybe give three names. Doesn't mean they're your top three, but just three that come to mind that you would like to hear from. So this is called Minnesota Stories, so that there's a connection to Minnesota.
Well, we're still recording, and I would tell you that I'm involved with the History Center of Olmsted County, and your doing these reminds us of what we're trying to do with that, which is, you know, some of it is actually just basic stories of, and I'm not going to name names, so I'm going to be more generic about it, but basic stories of people who, military stories, of course, are amazing, and we need to capture those. But boy, you are asking for three names, aren't you? Don Frericks. He's a former state rep in my district.
I don't do this to get you in trouble. I do it to make my job easier to find the next person to interview. And to, you know, if you're interested, I expect other people are too.
I'm going to have to cut this one down. Should have thought of this ahead of time. Let's see. Well, you should talk to Tyler Cadlick. And
he's with Cadillac Honda.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's one of the sons. I taught Tony to drive, but I think Tyler's probably a little more entertaining of an interview. Just my sense.
Okay.
Tony's a good guy too, though. Who else? I'm sorry. I'll have to get back to you on the third one.
No problem. Thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to continuing to see you represent Rochester at the state capitol.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Minnesota Stories. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if there's anybody you'd like to hear from, let us know. We would love to hear their Minnesota story as well.